Hello, I'm Emma Rutland, the Duchess of Rutland, and I'm inviting you to join me on season 3 of my podcast, Duchess. In the show, we explore the most historic homes of the UK and Ireland and meet the inspiring women who lead them. This is Duchess. Cumbria is the very heart of Great Britain, an area associated with the very image that defines British beauty. Hushed mountains, verdant fields, and the ever-glistening Lake District. Sitting in the curb of this treasured area is also one of heritage's best examples of a great home, Hutton in the Forest. Just as the name implies, this house rests in the centre of an ancient wood. Architecturally, Hutton in the Forest is representative of its enduring quality. First a watchtower built in the 14th century, the house has been added extensively over time, with its crenellated towers, Renaissance-style facade, light stonework, and tastefully designed proportions. Hutton has a wonderful sense of contrast, drama, and differing styles. Once the home to the Crown Forester, Hutton in the Forest is connected to some of England's greatest works of literature, gardens, and in the present day, continues to attract some of the world's greatest artists. This is where we find our guest, Lady Inglewood, of the historic Fletcher Vane family today. In the episode, I learned about the significance of Royal Forest in the medieval world. Lady Inglewood takes me through her exceptional gardening pedigree, and we discuss the serendipitous origins of her world-famous potfest. Well, today, listeners, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Lady Inglewood, whose first name is Cressida. So your family name is Fletcher Vane.
Yes. I mean, the Fletchers moved in here in early 1600s, and then Vanes married Fletchers. So depending who you talk to, some of them call themselves Fletcher Vane, some just Vane.
But the title is actually a different surname altogether. So how does that come about?
Well, I think there have been plenty of Vanes over the years who've been knighted or baroneted or so on. And since we live in the Forest of Inglewood, that's the title that my father-in-law chose when he was given a peerage by Macmillan.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It's a great honour for me to have you on my podcast, Duchess. So the first known historical reference to your home is in 1292, when Edward I visited Thomas de Houghton. I think that's right. Can you give us a very brief background into Hutton in the Forest and how it came to be and why it was built?
It was a manor, a fortified place in the Royal Forest of Inglewood, which was a very important royal forest, stretching from 30 miles, really, from Penrith right up to the Scottish border. And I think it was quite a strategic place because you weren't really meant to live much in forests unless you were looking after them like they were here. And so it meant that you had a corridor that was governed and stopped people going up and down across the border, or you knew who was going. I mean, it was the Scots who came marauding over the border, which meant that there are a lot of fortified places around here. Immensely thick walls they all have, and people would lock themselves and their animals in there and wait for the Scots to go away again. The Duchottons lived here until they ran out of money, I think, and then they sold up to the Fletchers in the early 1600s. And really, every generation, including them, has never had enough money to do very much, but everybody's done a bit. So the house goes through wonderful change of styles and periods. And it is the most beautiful coloured stone, very pale grey pink.
And as you rightly say, the lovely way of putting it, Cressida, everyone does their bit to keep these magnificent buildings together. So Hutton was built
to be the home of the Crown Forester of the Royal Inglewood Forest, the second largest forest in England at the time. Can you enlighten us on what a Crown Forester was?
I think the Crown Forester was the administrator on behalf of the Crown, and Hatton was one of three manors in the Forest of Inglewood. So they looked after the place on behalf of the Crown for hundreds of years.
And they created a very special walled garden, I think, in the middle pond.
There is the 18th century walled garden, which has got rather wonderful tall brick walls. And we have an engraving of 1700, a Kip engraving, and it shows it as a Dutch garden. And over the years, it has changed, obviously. But there it still is. It's a beautiful space. And we fill it with flowers.
And these gardens are open to the public?
Yes. And the pond that you referred to is at the other end, three ponds. But I think in the beginning, it was for fish, probably, and stocks. But now it's just a lovely sheet of water with ducks, some geese, occasional swans.
Wonderful.
Which we look out on.
How stunning. Could you tell us a little bit about your own lineage? Because you are described as hailing from an excellent gardening stock.
Yes, well, I have three good Victorian forebears. Paxton, Joseph Paxton, who was started off, I think, very, very young as head gardener to the Duke of Devonshire at Chatsworth, and is the designer of the Crystal Palace, which is a very remarkable building. Thomas Cubitt, who built a great deal of Victorian London, is also one of my great-great-grandparents. And then Dean Hole, who was a famous Victorian clergyman, but also very, very keen on gardens and founded the National Rose Society.
How wonderful. Are any of your children interested in gardening?
Well, I think so, but I think really until you have your own place, you know, you need your own space and place and room, and then you really get going. But our eldest daughter is now married in Kent, and she's beginning to think gardening.
Lovely. So Hutton is surrounded by beautiful landscape, and within the estate are splendid gardens. Can you tell us about the history and what role you have taken in preserving and developing them?
Well, I think, as you say, it is a very, very beautiful space. And I think space is actually extremely important in a garden, as well as flowers or whatever else. I have done small changes, I suppose. I mean, I've changed the colour of the gravel, changed the colour of the windows of the house. We have made a big change between here and the pond, which you referred to, and it's now a wildflower garden, has been now for towards 10 years, but we mow various paths through it, making shapes. So in a way, some of it is simplifying, but it is just trying to be a very beautiful space that is a lovely, peaceful place to be in. And I mean, I think a garden can be a work of art. It needn't be a work of art, but every garden is different and everybody's trying to do different things with their garden.
And Sir Henry Vane was a great planter, I'm correct.
He certainly planted 50,000 trees, so he did his bit in the 18th century.
And do you have a special spot in your grounds?
I think it depends what time of year you ask that question. In the worst weather, it's definitely the Cascade, because the more it rains, the more tumbles over the Cascade and the better it looks. And then a month ago, I suppose, the snowdrops. Really, I mean, they are just magic how they come out of nowhere. You get clouds of snowdrops. And now they're fading away. Daffodils are coming. So it really depends. And then when flowers get going in the walled garden, that becomes very special.
Where do you think your love of gardens truly came from?
Well, I suppose I've always grown up in lovely gardens and spaces. All my grandparents lived with wonderful gardens, so it's just been part of my life.
And what is the secret for you of a great British garden?
Well, I think climate is very good for gardening in England, isn't it? At one point, I thought I would like to, well, certainly do an article on gardens in Mexico. And so I went there and I tried and tried, but it's not the right place for gardens. So, I mean, you can go down to the Mediterranean, and a lot of the English have made wonderful gardens there, around the Mediterranean, for instance. So it is a sort of English characteristic, but I think it is born from probably the climate here and all the wonderful things that grow here.
Exactly. And that richness. And the rainfall, of course, that we all slightly dread at times. Cressida, could you tell us a tiny bit about Margaret Gladstone, who is said to have been responsible for much of the character of the house that we see today?
Well, She married Sir Henry Vane in 1870, and she was a cousin of Gladstone, the Prime Minister. And she was a great sort of arts and crafts person. So although the sort of bones of the garden are still there and much earlier, she planted a lot of topiary, which are now really rather wonderful shapes. It has a life of its own in the garden. And we've got a lot of William Morris wallpapers in the house, which I think she must have been responsible for. And she clearly did a lot in and around the house, and I would like to have met her.
Oh, that's so lovely, Krista. I feel so similar to you about certain ladies here. Could you also tell us about Mary Fletcher Vane, who was a very important figure in her day?
My mother-in-law, Richard's mother, she was terrific. And I think being married to an MP for a start was a lot of work. After the war, they came here and there was very little money and they did what they could. Anyway, she did a lot of local work and she was on the county council and she was a magistrate and she was obviously clearly a very good chairman, which is a quality that Richard, my husband, has inherited. So she did a lot of public work, both in London before she was married. She was actually a major in the army, but a senior commander in the army during the war. So that was quite something for a woman.
Amazing woman. And how would you describe your role today on the estate?
Well, I'm fairly practical. I'm interested in the buildings or in building in general, and I love the garden. So much of what I do is just keeping things going, I guess.
And do you feel supported and understood in that role?
Well, I think we've got a small, terrific team. And so we all try and help each other and get things done when they need to and try and work together.
Teamwork. Proper teamwork.
That's incredible. Communication and teamwork, really important.
And just tell us a little bit about the period of this fabulous home that you live in.
Well, it's just the mixture of it, which is so wonderful. You've got the sort of medieval peel tower, the sort of fortified bit, which is now in one corner, the entrance with immensely thick walls. You've then got the gallery with a cloistered space below, which was built in the 1630s. You've got a very, very beautiful central late 17th century insert, which looks rather like a sort of French townhouse stuck in the middle of the house. And then you've got the Cupid room, another very beautiful room, a bit later on. And the Victorians had a go as well. Salvin, who was, I think, a friend of the family as well as being a good architect, and he did a lot of work in the north of England. And he did some pretty good work here. And I think at one point, he was asked to do a design to redo the whole of the front of the house. And he said, no, hang on, you know, keep the middle bit. So they added to the castellation. So some of the castellations are 17th century and some are 19th century.
So it's a kaleidoscope of different designs and styles.
Yes, yes. And then we did our bit when we had a year of building works trying to sort out the bit we live in.
It has to be said, the finest room in the house is apparently the Cupid room. Can you tell us about this room?
It is a lovely room. I mean, it's a very perfect room and it does have this lovely Cupid centrepiece. It's a Rococo room. When we took over here, really, it was a broom cupboard, more or less. It was full of furniture and the ceiling was a sort of Wedgwood blue and white and gold, and the walls were dark red. I think it had a makeover in the arts and crafts time. And we took advice, because we couldn't agree ourselves what to do, and took it back to a very gentle colour scheme. And it is a lovely room. And we have a Hogarth painting of Vane's, which hangs in there.
Fabulous.
What I love so much about speaking to Lady Inglewood is how poised and articulate she is when describing her home. Although we are not in the same room, she paints such a vivid and radiant portrait with her words. I really feel like I'm witnessing her stunning estate with my very own eyes. Since we began Duchess the podcast, so many of you have reached out expressing the wish to make listening to Duchess a reality. We adore making this podcast, but we know nothing compares to experiencing these beautiful places for yourself. So, for people who want a once-in-a-lifetime experience, we've partnered with the award-winning luxury travel company Abercrombie & Kent to bring our much-loved podcast to life. from guided tours, stays in grand rooms, fishing trips on the family lake, to private tours of beautiful gardens, our partnership with Abercrombie & Kent will enable you to experience Duchess, the podcast, for yourself from Inverary to Beaver and beyond. With Abercrombie & Kent, you can come and stay, visit and explore the houses that are featured in our series Duchess. Our partnership with Abercrombie and Kent will enable you to experience Duchess the podcast for yourself with your own tailor-made itinerary. For more information, visit abercrombiekent.co.uk/duchess. We'll put a link in the show notes. This is just a quick reminder that you're listening to Duchess, hosted by me, Emma Rutland. And this is a podcast produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. Coming up in the podcast, Lady Inglewood takes us through the magnificent William Morris interiors, and Lady Inglewood describes the moment she came across a secret spiral staircase. But first, I really wanted to know whether Hutton's famed connection with one of the English literature's greatest ever poems was true.
So Hutton in the Forest has captured the imagination of poets. In particular, is said to be featured in the legendary epic poem Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Could you tell us a little bit about this?
Well, apparently in one version of the poem, it says that the Green Knight rode to the Knight's Castle of Hutton. And we very firmly say that's definitely us. I mean, it certainly is the most wonderful poem, well worth reading anybody who likes medieval literature, and a wonderful idea that this might be one of the key places in it.
Oh, that's lovely. So if I may, I'd like to move now into your fabulous interiors. Describe the room that you're sitting in now and tell us about this room and the colour and the design of the decor.
Well, we are in what I think our children would call our living room. It was, I think, Sir Henry Vane's smoking room, and it is full of lots of paintings, which are ones that we've collected. A very beautiful table made out of one single plank of elm from my grandfather, and lots of flowers and plants.
So you love your houseplants?
At this time of year, I love my houseplants, yes.
And have you got a big greenhouse where you bring them all on?
Not enough. No, we have several small, what we call Radio Times greenhouses. I think all the big greenhouses were taken down after the war, and I've never managed to get a decent sized one again.
So Hutton in the Forest has some gorgeous interiors. Could you walk us through some of the different styles and designs in the estate? Tell us about your favourite rooms, and in particular, could you tell our listeners about William Morris and the stunning work he carried out at your home?
Well, I think this goes back to Margaret Gladstone, Margaret Vane, who clearly, she got a lot of Morris wallpaper, some of them which you would never guess were Morris, and I think must have been very early ones. The drawing room, for instance, which has never been touched since she decorated it in about the 1880s, I should think, you would never imagine was a Morris paper. And then several of the others are more typical. Some of them were overpainted by Richard's parents after the war, but we do have bits of those in the attic, so we do know what there has been here as well. And I'm a great Morris fan. I think they're terrific.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And they have had a huge surge of interest now. I mean, everyone seems to have collections of William Morris styled things in their gift shops, and National Trust have got a whole range that they sell, haven't they? And if you, like me, go and visit all the trade fairs where we do all our buying for our shops, you can buy William Morris aprons, everything in William Morris.
I think it's more sort of Rococo than you'd expect from William Morris, the paper in the drawing room. It's a pale sort of, what do you call it, O'Donnell blue. Anyway, it is sort of greeny blues, and the windows are equally painted a greeny blue, and the woodwork and the ceiling. Other wallpapers, the one in Lady Darlington's room, which is a very well-known wallpaper, and everybody will immediately recognise it, of pomegranates and oranges and lemons, is equally makes a lovely room. And it's got dark green panelling in there. And then others of the room have got oak panelling. And that's always a wonderful warm background for living in.
Sounds fabulous. So have you ever come across any secret rooms at Hutton in the Forest?
Not really, but I was, during lockdown, one of the things I did was go through the attics, which it had been a long time since anybody had really tried to rationalise them. So in a sense, they're much duller than they were, but I sort of put up some shelves and put things off the floor. But anyway, in the corner of the furniture attic, I did find the top of a spiral staircase in a cupboard, so to speak, which I certainly hadn't known about. So it was quite exciting, really, to suddenly see these spiral stairs.
And did you make your way down, or was it being blocked?
I don't think you could get very far down. Some dead birds had made their way down there, but not much else.
It is very exciting finding these things, isn't it? And they never stop surprising us, these houses. There's always something else behind another cupboard door that could lead you to that pot of treasure, I suppose.
Well, wouldn't it be? So we had metal detectors here not long ago. I'm glad to say they found some Roman coins. And I always knew the Romans had been around, but it was very satisfactory.
So tell us about the gallery, Cressida.
Well, it's a rather wonderful space, and it is quite unusual, apparently, in the north of England to have a gallery. You go in there, and there's a lot of oak furniture, two rather handsome court cupboards, which must be pretty old. I can't remember, but I mean, 17th century, probably. And when you open the doors, you find they've got enormous great pipes inside, and the Victorians converted them to put some heating in them, which always makes me laugh when you think of people now with televisions in cabinets and things. Well, there's nothing new.
No, nothing new. So the house, Cressida, also contains a number of 17th and 18th century portraits by female artists. Could you tell us a tiny bit about these?
It's a good collection of English portraits here in this house, going right through. And there are portraits by women, by Lucy Carlyle, Maria Verlest, and by Mary Beale. In the house, there's almost nothing but portraits, which I think is true of many English houses. So we have introduced a few other paintings to the front of the house. And we've also made a very good collection, I think, of English ceramics. Well, not just English, in fact, because we have this Potfest, which until Brexit was international. And we used to get at least a third of the potters from Europe. Now, I think, because of the bureaucracy, it's much more difficult for them to come. So I fear that we'll get many fewer in the future from Europe, and we used to get some from Japan and so on.
How amazing. I'd like to come to that. So Hutton has also built up the collection of contemporary ceramics since hosting Potfest in the park. If you wouldn't mind, Cressida, just tell our listeners about this festival and about Hutton's ceramic collection.
Well, neighbour who is a potter, Jeff Cox, he approached us towards 20 years ago, asking whether we'd be happy to host a pot fest, which was something which hadn't really happened much in England, had happened over several places in Europe before. And he's been the most wonderful person to work with, and his son has now taken over from him. He's taken huge trouble, the placing of every marquee and citing everything. And it's very much an outdoor event. So all the potters are facing outwards out of their tents. And people come back year after year, and so do some of the potters, and some of them are new every year. It's just a very happy event, and potters are an extremely nice breed of people, and they're very generous towards each other. So you'll go one day and somebody's having a very good time and somebody else hasn't had such a good day, but they never feel any envy, I suppose. You know, they just take it how it is.
All over Europe, apparently, and even Japan has been represented at your Potfest.
Yes, there was one year when we had a lot of Japanese who came over, and at the end of the festival, there was this little line of potters coming, each sort of bearing a tiny thank you pot. So we got this lovely collection of, you know, rather special one that came from that year from them as well.
And works from the famous Martin McWilliam and Peter Beard, is that right?
Yes, no, well, there are two. I mean, and we've got lovely pots in our own collection of their work as well. And then one of my favourite, it's an enormous pot, which was made by a pied-noir, a Frenchman from Algeria, I suppose. And it was incredibly heavy to bring it into the house, quite a performance getting it into the house when we bought it. And then I said, you know, please, you know, can I have your address? Because it's nice to know the details of what we bought. And he said, oh, je vive dans les bois. I live in the woods. I don't have an address.
Oh, how lovely. How perfect. And where is that pot now?
It's now in the library. It would be nice to have it outside. I mean, it's wonderful because you can see the sort of African influence on it. But he says it's not proof against the weather. So it sits inside.
So what is it like sharing your home with the public?
Well, I suppose there's in the front of the house, the big dining room and the hall are rooms that we use much more in the winter when the house isn't open to the public. And we occasionally move in there in the summer when we're more than 12 people. But on the whole, it's a pleasure. We do keep everything in much better order than we probably would if people weren't coming round. So that's quite a good discipline.
And also, the great thing is it enables us to keep the roof on, doesn't it?
Well, of course, yes, yes, no.
How many days are you open to the public each year, Krista?
Well, the gardens, which open in at the end of March, will be open until the end of October, 6 days a week. And the house opens and the tea room 3 days a week, and then for groups or events in addition. But we're really quite small time in the house opening stakes, so to speak.
And how was it balancing raising a modern day family and being a custodian?
I think there were times when the children didn't like it. So you would suddenly find them sitting inside watching television on a lovely day because they said, you know, there's people wandering around the garden. But I mean, they grew out of that sort of stage of their lives. And I hope for them it's been a lovely place to grow up. Again, as teenagers, there were moments when they would much prefer to have lived in London and been where all their friends are. But no, I think they're all very fond of it.
That's lovely. And what are the ambitions for Hutton in the Forest in the future?
Well, there's quite a lot of woodland the other side of the Beck, which has been neglected for really quite a long time. I mean, the two wars took their toll on all these places. And Richard's keen to bring that back. And all the time just doing small things, trying to get things better, get the planting better. Got a very good gardener working. You know, it's exciting. Every year, putting in some different things. Some work, some don't. Some successes, some disappointments.
But as you say, Rome is not built in a day with heritage. It's just plodding on. A little every year.
Absolutely.
So, do you feel a responsibility, Krista, to preserve the house for future generations?
Yes, certainly. I mean, very much feel that one's hoping to enjoy living here, which we do, and definitely trying to work with the building. And one's just part of a long line of people.
Exactly. So one of my favourite questions that I love to ask, and I know asking you today, Krista, there's going to be very pragmatic and practical replies to this. What would you say to the woman at Hutton in the Forest, six generations in the past, if she was sitting at that wonderful long dining table with you today?
Dear, they couldn't imagine, could they, what would happen? I mean, I just begin to feel very old. 100 years now doesn't seem to be very long that I've hit 70. So realise that time sort of telescopes. I just think everything is so unbelievably different now. I think it's probably much easier being a woman now than it was then often.
And so likewise, six generations of your offspring that you're talking to, again, in the middle of the dining table, what would you say to them? What would be your advice?
Enjoy it as much as you can. Live for the present. I mean, you know, you've got to live for the moment, haven't you?
I think that's the best advice to anyone listening to this unbelievable conversation in this incredibly difficult time that we're in. And it's been a total joy, Krista, talking to you in your very frank, down-to-earth approach to running heritage, which I have to say is totally refreshing and will make our listeners smile on so many occasions. God bless you, and thank you, Krista.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
There are many things I have adored about my conversation with Lady Inglewood today. I've adored learning about the magnificent gardening tradition at Hutton. I've adored to hear there are still homes that have preserved so many beautiful, original William Morris interiors. And I also adored learning about the history of strong women here. But most of all, I've adored getting acquainted with Lady Inglewood. From her, I get such a wonderful sense of strength and clarity. It's amazing to meet incredible women like her, and I'm so happy precious pieces of heritage are now safe in her hands. Thank you so much, Lady Inglewood, for sharing this time with us, and thank you everyone at home for listening. Next week on the podcast, I meet Alice Kennard of Ford Abbey. In this episode, we discuss the fascinating monastic history of Ford Abbey. Alice explains to me why her home is such an eclectic architectural mix. And I learn about the highly coveted Raphael tapestry that hangs on the Abbey wall. We will see you there. With Her Majesty the Queen's Platinum Jubilee this year, we want to mark this momentous occasion by celebrating women in public service and heritage today. Join me, Emma Rutland, and my dear friend, Nicholas Coleridge, CBE, Chairman of the Victoria and Albert Museum and former President of Condé Nast, at Beaver Castle on the 30th of June for a live Q&A with some of my previous guests on Duchess, celebrating the Queen's Platinum Jubilee and the third series of Duchess. The Q&A will be followed by a scrumptious lunch in the state dining room at my very own Beaver Castle, where you can meet the incredible women who've inspired and appeared on Duchess. You will also have the opportunity to tour the castle and gardens for free. Hurry, there is only 100 tickets on sale for this exclusive event. You can find more information about this event on our website, www.duchessthepodcast.com. I very much look forward to welcoming you to Beaver very soon. With summer approaching and spring in full swing, picnics and walks in Bluebell Woods can return. We've been busy designing a range of high quality, sustainable products perfect for taking on your picnic this summer. Handmade in the UK and designed by me, our products are helping to diminish the use of single-use plastics and bringing you elegant, sustainable alternatives. To view our range of gorgeous products, go to our website www.duchessthepodcast.com or through our Instagram account at Duchess the Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. There are just a few quick notes before we go. Make sure you follow Duchess wherever you listen to podcasts. One of my favourite things about the podcast is learning more about you and hearing your stories. So please write to me, tell me about your own lineage, and share with me the women who've inspired you in your life, at Duchess, thepodcast.com. You've been listening to Duchess, the podcast presented by me, Emma Rutland, the Duchess of Rutland, produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer, Kasra Ferruzia is the editor and audio-visual engineer, Connor Foley is the producer and researcher. Additional creative support from Selena Christofides. Lady Violet Manners, my daughter, is executive producer with additional support from Henry Merrick. Thank you so much for listening to Duchess.